Hey, buttheads. Welcome back to Bob's Max is Not a Butthead. I'm Richard. Hey, Kyle. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing all right, Richard. And it's good to be back on another episode of Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead.
It's so wonderful.
I'm glad to be here.
I am also glad to be here. And I think this episode is another reason why I am so happy we're doing this. Choosing to pick everything because, man, I had not seen that Amazing Stories episode that he did.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah,
so much
let's tell them what it is that we're excited about. I mean, because a lot of the films we've covered thus far, I feel the same way, are you know, things we're revisiting. Obviously, neither one of us had seen I Want to Hold Your Hand before we started this, and that was fantastic. And
same with
so,
these cars.
Yeah, and the... I don't think I ever would have gotten around to seeing Amazing Stories or even really was. Once I started poking through it, I think I'd actually seen some of the series before. Mm-hmm. But I certainly don't think I would have voluntarily just gone out and sought out this particular episode. And I am glad I did because it was really fun. And we also watched the early Zemeckis shorts as mm-hmm. well, which we're going to talk about finally on this episode, which kind of brings certain elements we'll bring certain things kind of full circle from where we started
yep.
At the beginning. But no, I'm really glad. This was a fun adventure of seeing a bunch of new Bob Zemeckis stuff. And so, that was really cool.
I think
it makes
things make a bit more sense, too. It's like a puzzle piece in his career, at least the shorts with the Amazing Stories, if you're looking yeah. ahead to something like Death Becomes Her or even What Lies Beneath, I feel, both of which I haven't seen, I feel, are echoed in this, having not seen them.
Yes, having seen both of those movies, I can see that for sure.
And A Field of Honor, I think, is very much in spirit with 1941,
thing. Let's tell everybody why it is. Why are we watching an old episode of a TV show called Amazing Stories? What is it? Why are we doing it on the Bob Zemeckis podcast, Richard?
Sure.
What brought us here?
So, in the mid-80s, Spielberg decided to do an anthology, a sci-fi fantasy anthology show based on the comic Amazing Stories. So, it was just a bunch of weird fantasy shorts, mostly in a 30-minute time block. Spielberg directed several of them himself and has story credit on some of them. Brad Bird has an episode that turned into the show Family Dog, which people may remember. I barely do. Scorsese directed an episode. Clint Eastwood directed an episode. Joe Dante. And Zemeckis was invited to do one of the few double episodes. The other one being The Mission, which I think is the most famous one. That's a big Spielberg one with, I think, mm-hmm. Kevin Costner in an airplane. He has to draw the wheels onto the plane so it can land in very Roger Rabbit style. I haven't watched it in years. I'm pretty sure that's how that one goes. But Zemeckis, on the heels of Back to the Future, gets the double episode Halloween episode Go to the Head of the Class, which mm-hmm. is a big horror comedy swing. Mm-hmm. Which is so fantastic.
Starring the great Christopher Lloyd, playing a character every bit as big as Doc Brown, but like a malevolent Doc Brown.
Almost splitting the difference between Doc Brown and Judge Doom.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Which is funny because he plays Doc Brown, this character, and then Judge Doom. Yep. Like, it's all back
right
to back
row.
To back. And I think going through, looking at his filmography and seeing these little interesting pockets, namely wanting to see the shorts and knowing that he'd done more television work than I assumed that he had done. Amazing mm-hmm. Stories, Tales from the Crypt, which we'll dive into, and mm-hmm. Johnny Bago, which we'll explain in a whole other episode. But
fantastic.
I thought it would be important for us to kind of see what he looks like on the small screen and mm-hmm. I kind of went into this thinking this would be kind of a victory lap for him after Back to the Future, and I kind of feel that he gets to play that that way, especially knowing that it's a double episode and seeing how big he goes.
Yeah, and it's a really cool story. So the idea is it was an anthology series, etc., and then his episode What is it about this episode? It's kind of a fun. I was delighted to discover what the episode was about because it synergized with a lot of my interests. In that it was kind of it clearly derived from the kind of satanic panic of the mid '80s, and was an episode about a young boy being corrupted by sex and dark music, which records he plays backwards, all to perform a ritual in a cemetery, all in the hope of getting even with Christopher Lloyd, who's kind of this kind of over the top, like kind of arch villain teacher, you know, who tortures students by making them hold books out and makes them swallow gum from under desks and everything. And just he's the whole first part is devoted to setting up this villain, this evil teacher, and anyway to get back at him, tempted by a girl who's very subtly named Sin.
Very subtly named Sin.
Yes, he performs this ritual, which of course requires a bone from the finger of a relative of Christopher Lloyd. So that sends them into a mausoleum. He retrieves the bone. He performs the ritual, and then they set out quite naively at the beginning that the spell is going to give him the hiccups or some childish sort of a thing. And it ends up killing him. And then he, of course, ends up, they end up scrambling, performing a ritual to bring him back. And then it becomes delightful after that.
Delightful 10 minutes. A very delightful. The best. And it just keeps going. I watched it again last night and was like checking the time because he goes on for... for such a big chunk of that episode, where it just continually reinvents itself to where that end chase is it's so much fun. I love it. People should go watch it.
Well, and that's the other fun thing about this is that you say it's Zemeckis on TV, but man, there's a lot of money being thrown around. I mean, I'm sure not Back to the Future money, but still the fact that the special effects were done by Stan Winston, and so all of this, so a large portion as they are resurrecting, they use various objects in their incantation, and as they're resurrecting Christopher Lloyd, they take a photograph. They have to use a photograph of him. They accidentally rip the head off the photograph, and so when he's resurrected, he kind of, not in a gory way, but just sort of in a headless horseman sort of a way, sits up, leaving his head behind, and there's a lot of fantastic gags, all just playing with this idea of a headless Christopher Lloyd, and using kind of fun match cuts and a lot of clearly built-in things with Christopher Lloyd hiding and putting his head through stuff. There's just some great hidden cuts throughout the thing where like great visual gags where like there will be clearly Christopher Lloyd's head and then the thing will jump into frame and hide a cut and then he'll grab the head and then all of a sudden it'll be the animatronic head, and it really and the animatronic head is fantastic.
It's so good. And they're so good. They are so proud of it too. You could tell.
Yeah, they really show it off.
They are not cutting around it. Like the head has like five like close up animatronic head moments where it holds and the eyes are moving and the mouth is grimacing.
And that's and also they made the wise decision to sculpt it into like a really extreme pose. So like it sells more authentically because it's that screaming face, and like half the time when you cut to it, like you're already hearing it screaming before the cut happens, so that by the time you cut to it, it feels like it's engaged in this really intense action. So it really just sells it, and he just has a lot of fun running around at the end, and a lot of it feels like to me like, God, when did Reanimator come out? Now I didn't
85.
Even think about
it. It was the year
85. Okay, right
year
around
before.
The same time.
Yeah.
Okay, so perfect. So it feels like he saw Reanimator and he thought, I could do a bunch more gags with that same idea, and then kind of does a kind of PG-rated version of a lot of the gags with Dr. whatever his name is in Reanimator, who carries around his own head and is a big creepo. And I'm fine with that, and it was really fucking fun. I loved that I got to see a Robert Zemeckis spooky cemetery. Mm-hmm. It looked exactly like what I was hoping it would look like. Very spooky and cemetery-like. I don't know. I mean, it was a rad fucking rad episode. One of the things, I actually changed shirts before we started this podcast. Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say, but I'm going to admit it. I changed shirts. I'm wearing a Death Scream Bloody Gore, which is, you know, in some estimations, the first death metal album from 1987, I think. And the reason I brought it up, or the reason I put it on, I thought it would be very appropriate to wear, because a very critical part of this episode is, you know, we have our, what is the, I don't even remember the protagonist's name. What is the guy's
Peter.
Name?
Peter. Mr. Brand?
Yes, Mr. Brand. Oh, that's perfect. Mr. Brand. So, Peter Brand. Mr. Brand, you know, he's a bit of a Marty McFly. He feels like he feels like the Eric Stoltz version of Marty McFly, mm-hmm. like maybe a slightly hepper, like Hepcat version.
And kind of looks like him, too.
Yes, and a little, you know, just sort of a doofus. And we see right away when we're, again, in classic Zemeckis style, we have a long shot. Oh, we didn't even talk about this at the beginning. The whole opening of the movie
is a
long shot from House on Haunted Hill. And I love House on Haunted Hill, and it's really interesting that he chose that particular scene.
Oh, I thought he shot that. I didn't know that was a real piece.
No. That's from a Vincent Price movie. And I remember watching that movie when I was a kid, and I remember that sequence, because that's interestingly a movie that plays with this idea the whole time of, are we really in a haunted house, or are we all being manipulated through you know, the doings? I do not remember the plot. It's been a long, 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 long time. I haven't seen it since I was a kid. But like Vincent Price, or is it Vincent Price just trying to convince people? Or someone trying to convince people there are ghosts. And that's right up until that last scene where a moment, I don't even think they show this part, but after it cuts away, it's revealed that the skeleton that's chasing the girl is in fact an elaborate marionette, and it was all part of a plan to like scare her. But it's also, she was a murderer or something. And,
murderous, you know,
it's yeah, exactly. It's a ghost getting revenge, all that. And then we, of course, have a great Zemeckis tracking shot that pulls away from that. And again, him shooting screens. He loves that he can shoot the screens now, the TV screens. We're introduced to a room, but one that sort of, in a very charmingly 1985 sort of a way, just kind of roundly conflates every interest that a kid who dresses in black might have, from like New Wave and like The Cure to like, apparently now he's getting into bands like Blood Sausage, which is, of course, which comes in. We portray that he's interested in dabbling in darker things, and he is obsessed with
Sin.
His girlfriend Sin, who he has pictures of all over his room. So what's interesting, though, what is interesting is how potent that opening scene, instead of just having them tumble into, not the scene in the room, but the first scene in the classroom, we're introduced to Christopher Lloyd, but then the dynamic, the incredibly loaded and complex dynamic between him and his girlfriend. Like, it doesn't play around with the idea that she's a bad influence or a temptation. It sort of explicitly codes her as that in the beginning, with the idea that not only is she copying off of his work, not only is that she because they're accused of plagiarism at the beginning, and clearly she's copied his paper, his homework, but that she is willing to sit by and let him take the blame, and in fact force him to take the blame for these things. And so she is almost less of a, and I don't think that, and this is not a criticism, she's almost less of a character than she is an abstraction. She is a devil on his shoulder. Her name is Sin. She is literally there to sit over his left shoulder in class and tempt him with bad shit, you know?
Well, I think it hits, like, and I think I was really struck back watching it again last night, is I made some notes on it the first time, but Christopher Lloyd is turned up to an 11 talking about Macbeth and how Lady Macbeth has corrupted Macbeth.
Oh, yeah.
And all of those shots of just like, he's like, oh, and it's the woman who's withholding sex, and it's a shot of her just chewing gum.
Yeah, no, when we say explicitly coded, we really mean it in the most explicit sense. Like, it says, this is Lady Macbeth. Everything that follows is about Shakespeare. The ghost of the person they murder returns, as is the case in many Shakespeare plays. Christopher Lloyd is obsessed with Shakespeare and reading from Shakespeare at the beginning. And so they're engaging directly with the idea, as we've discussed. This is the case in many of Zemeckis's films. He's engaging directly with the idea of classical archetypes, and even making classical archetypes part of the text of the movie, just so you're not confused, you know. Which sets our character up, Peter Brand, as a really empathetic, you know, if not someone you can respect, kind of an empathetic guy, because we see that he's such a pushover that he's willing to confess you know, to a crime he didn't commit so that his girlfriend's sin can continue to take advantage of him. And then in the next moment, in the next scene, she is tempting him to get back at the professor for what he did, sending him into detention by performing what? A magical ritual that they learned by playing the blood sausage record backwards. And that's kind of immediately when I perked up watching this episode, and hence the t-shirt that I'm wearing now. Because this came out in 1986, so that would have been like right on the heels, 1985, of the PMRC hearings, where famously, you know, anyone who grew up with VH1 when they were a kid, I'm sure, is very familiar, because they would always be covered extensively. When Tipper Gore, you know, famously told the anecdote of her traumatic experience of having overheard her daughter listening to a Prince record. Song "Darling Nikki" that had the word masturbation in it, masturbating actually, and then as a result, Tipper Gore launched a campaign to increase parental control over the tastes or over the music habits of their kids. So, and then ultimately lobbied. It's the same kind of thing that happened with the MPAA, basically threatening the record industry, embarrassing them publicly, making them show up to hearings, etc. To call them morally repugnant, and then ask them to, you know, voluntarily put warning labels so as to avoid regulation. So, and what ended up happening is it became, you know, a public hearing, and Dee Snider and Frank Zappa and John Denver of all people showed up to defend, you know, music and freedom of expression and that sort of thing. But all of where it all started was them identifying, I think it was called the Filthy 15, you know, and as much hay was made of, like, this all started because of her listening to a Prince record, they needed shocking material. You know, they needed proof that music was pornography and that it needed to be regulated. And so they compiled a list of, you know, these Filthy 15 records, which had like a couple popular records on it, like a vulgar Cyndi Lauper song and a Prince song. But like the other 11 songs on the thing were all obscure death metal and extreme metal and heavy metal songs, you know, so that they could have songs that explicitly dealt with anything that would scare moms, you know, Satanism, drugs, all of that. So they're like, Wasp was on there, and Merciful Fate, and Venom was on there, even though Venom was a band that was the most famous they ever got was being part of that PMRC list.
And they were like, yeah!
Exactly. So as a result of this sort of thing, so anyway, as a big metal fan myself, I'm wearing the t-shirt right now, it is interesting to look at this within that context and realize that this is sort of a kind of literalization of, or I should say mythologization, if that's a word, a spooky ghost story around the scare stories that were created by the PMRC. The idea that they're all, and of course incorporating a little bit of classic Beatles, you know, playing records backwards to get hidden messages. He adds that element in there, and we have a story about like a spooky, clearly coded to be death metal in kind of a silly way, blood sausage record being played backwards. You get the things, and what if the records actually are full of coded messages, and what if they actually are turning kids into Satanists, and which is interesting. It's kind of gives me a complicated relationship with this episode at the same time, because I love it. It's clearly it's like Tales from the Crypt. I like seeing all of that goofy shit in there. I like all of that, and yet I'm aware at the same time that like the iconography that was now being kind of pumped into the zeitgeist, the sort of visual iconography of metal records being dangerous and evil and yada 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 would ultimately kind of metastasize by the mid 90s, if you've ever watched the Paradise Lost documentaries and yada yada yada, into, you know, kids being like sent to prison and accused of crimes for wearing heavy metal shirts, which was relevant to me because that was personally how I looked and dressed in the mid 90s
and today.
But still, nevertheless, it's just interesting to look at it as an artifact of that period, because is it still kind of a film that, you know, looks at, in the same way Back to the Future showed a kind of fallen world that was characterized by, you know, kind of the weakness of Marty's father, and there was trash in the streets, and there's a XXX theater on Main Street, yada yada yada. You know, kind of dark music slash death metal kind of jumps into the drive, takes that place in this, and is kind of a symptom or a concretization of all of the kind of the decline of civilization and the temptation for towards sin, which is everywhere and now is tempting our Peter Brand to go and dig up bodies in the night in the cemetery and all of that. So, yeah, man.
That's a great summary of something I'd never, I don't know anything about, Kyle. Thank you.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I just assumed.
That's all news. That's all news to me. And I think the one thing that I want to make sure that we touch on, because this is something that looking at I Want to Hold Your Hand and Romancing the Stone and even Back to the Future, seeing Christopher Lloyd write sex super big on a chalkboard was like, that's the guy. That's our guy. He's right there. Just at this point, it's become so explicit that the villain is writing sex on the chalkboard. That's just the level that he's operating at right now. It's like right in your face.
And that's what I mean. And it's clearly, and that's why I say that there's, you know, relationship between, you know, I love that his name is, what is his name? Beans?
Mr. Beans.
Exactly. Mr. Beans. I love it.
It's a joke. It's so funny.
And it's worth mentioning, you know, because we'll get to the Zemeckis shorts later on, and we've brought it up many, many times before. You know, the shorts are very Chuck Jonesy. Obviously, a lot of his early stuff is very Chuck Jonesy, and the big cartoony performances, which kind of were all over the place in his early shorts, and then began to be refined, and then kind of perfected and integrated in a grounded way in Back to the Future. Is done really well here, and that there is that really interesting balance between the protagonist feels like we can empathize with his predicament with his girlfriend in a real way, even though she's kind of this weird mustache twisting villain, and yet like he still occupies the same world. Like Marty kind of feels a little bit like a real kid, and yet Doc Brown occupies the same world and is this, you know, basically just a mad scientist directly out of a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And then we have Mr. Professor Beans, who is kind of like, again, dark Doc Brown, where the hair is fallen and turned black, and he's yelling at everyone. He's just constantly using like this really erudite diction to talk down to how stupid and base and fallen all of the kids in the class are, and that the only thing that their TV-soaked minds would respect is sex. So he writes sex on the board in big letters just again. Then he says, I hope I got your fucking attention now, you pieces of shit. And he just slaps them all in the face or something like that.
Basically. I made a note, like his performance is Shakespearean, it feels very very specific in the vocal quality, and the thing I noticed watching it again, which Zemeckis does across his, at least in Back to the Future, like a bunch, he's got an ascot on at the beginning, which just is a character piece that lets you know how big of an asshole he is, which of course comes full circle at the end, because it's now a scarf hiding the neck thing. But just that one little detail of him wearing an ascot in a high school class is like, oh, this guy is so pretentious. Of course, we have to do something to him.
Yeah, and it's worth noting in all of this how much this feels like a Tales from the Crypt episode. It feels like a less R-rated, a not R-rated Tales from the Crypt episode, in that it's about a character who, you know, which in that sense, you know, you can see that the influences come from old EC comics or crime comics and horror comics or whatever. You have this character, which, you know, I'm only familiar with through Tales from the Crypt, but in that sense, it feels very much like that. You have the kind of flawed character who's tempted, does something bad, kill someone they didn't intend to kill, and that person comes back from the dead and gets them. And, you know, that's a lot of Tales from the Crypt episodes, but what's kind of fun about this is that in the freedom that Tales from the Crypt had to be super duper dark, super duper R-rated, have violence and many great episodes, this was kind of just fun in that, like, that his head wasn't cut off in some gory way. It kind of reminded me, this is what I'm, it reminded me of films like Houseu, like the Japanese haunted house movie, where they do just silly shit, like people get possessed with ghosts and their heads pop off and fly around the room and they toss them around like basketballs and they're screaming. You would love it, Richard. You love Evil Dead 2. You love that.
I do love Evil Dead 2.
And in that sense, it felt, there was something quite charming and almost more nightmare-like about the thing, especially near the end when there's a kind of long sequence of Peter Brand running away from this with this amazing low angle shot of with like that one shot of the head under Christopher Lloyd's arm while that low angle shot while the headless body is running. Is that with a lightning crashing? It's amazing. And in that sense, it by the end feels like a nightmare. It's like my teacher. He was chasing me down my street. He didn't have a head on.
There was lightning, and the wind is like enormous. Yeah, and he's of course wearing the robe, which is like the amount of wind in that end sequence is staggering.
Yeah. And I don't know. It just felt very, it had a dreamlike quality, which is, of course, all building toward the kind of, double bluff ending with, there's a very explicit setup at the beginning that makes you, where literally the boy, right before we cross the threshold kind of into the spiritual realm, where everything prior to that is the kind of shit that could happen to a kid, sort of. Right before we start getting into magical rituals, he falls back, bumps his head, passes out, wakes back up, you know. And obviously that's our transition. Now we're in the spiritual world. Now a monster hand, you know, or monster hand happens before that, but soon the girl crawls in through his window. They're performing crazy magic that's working, all this other shit. So we're assuming that, of course, we're going to return to that moment later on, and we do when he wakes back up. But it turns into a fun dark double bluff as we assume that it was all a dream. And he returns to school the next day only to have, yes, a very Freddy Krueger kind of a moment at the end where it's, of course, revealed that Mr. Beans is alive but missing his head, and a wonderful sequence where everyone's writing in perfect unison and his girlfriend is at the front of the class meeting the misters.
It becomes a nightmare all over again. It is very creepy to see all of them, all the hands going in motion. I didn't notice that until the second time. And of course she's out of her black leather jacket and just in this, like, she's a girl again instead of evil incarnate, basically, or the seductress.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I think that actually was really interesting to see her costume changed at the end, because almost the idea that you would know, it's a subconscious little thing that tips you off to the fact that, you know, she has somehow been tamed more, like, out, like, she is not the same person anymore. She has been, you know, just not just that she got in trouble, but she has sort of been broken in some way. Yeah. What I dig about the whole thing is that he uses that, you know, he passes out, she comes in, they start doing the magical ritual in his room, and he uses that as the jumping off point to get very surreal and dreamlike with all of the production. Like, when we get to the cemetery, the cemetery feels, again, like we're escalating almost into a different genre of movie, you know? Everything that happened before that, it feels a little, feels pretty John Hughes-y, you know?
Right.
And then that's when all of a sudden we have transitioned into, we first cut to the cemetery and it's moss and it's fog and it's
so
all this
Vestry's
stuff.
He's got the big church organ music, Brian.
Yeah. Yep. And that's all great. And what's also interesting is how they spend a lot of time on the actual ritual itself with, like, weird rose water and all sorts of other stuff. So they took a moment to, like, research and figure out, like, what would a witchcraft ritual look. Of course, it also has all sorts of wonderful little silly things in it, like a bat wing that needs to be acquired. The things that push it just make the push it a little bit outside the bounds of reality. A hilarious sequence. I love the... I love that gag where they're opening this. They're opening the coffin only to reveal its feet. It's a great,
yeah.
It's a great little gag.
Damn, wrong side.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was gonna, like, you mentioned. There's one thing I want to kind of say. You mentioned, like, this played on network TV, that makes it doubly more impressive. We're talking about Tales from the Crypt, which obviously was HBO, but this played on, like, CBS or something in a primetime slot, which is awesome. Awesome.
It is great. Yeah,
and I mean, talking about the gore and the nightmare stuff, like, this is a pretty awesome piece of network network television. And
no, it made me want to watch the rest of Amazing Stories, so, which I think I might actually have to do now. I love the Amazing Stories opening sequence where it takes you from like caveman all the way through the history of stories, all the way back to the caveman, back on the television it's the hearth, you know, the fire around which we're telling stories now. It feels like a very, very Spielbergian thing to do. So, yeah, I like it.
And I think, too, like you mentioned, like the production design of the cemetery and the mm-hmm. mausoleum. Like when I watched it the first time, I think I texted it this to you before you watched it. I was like, it feels like he's butting up against the edges of a television production budget, mm-hmm. but spending all the money in exactly the right ways to mm-hmm. make the thing effective, because it's just a classroom and nothing is big and crazy in the classroom. But when we get to the cemetery, oh my gosh, there's so much fog and mm-hmm. there's lightning and that mausoleum feels like something out of Goonies or Raiders of the Lost Ark. Still mm-hmm. has that television feel, but it feels like I don't know. It just felt like they spent the money in all the right places, mm-hmm. with the head especially too. And when when they do perform the ritual, and it's the kind of joke we had about Peter Jackson. He's like, he mm-hmm. always makes things an 11. Like he has very little restraint. He just goes over the top immediately every time. Yeah. And I felt that watching that fire come up out of the urn, because at that point something was just so surprising about that level of flame. Like, and that color flame too.
Let's talk about restraint though for a second, because you know, especially because we just watched, it's kind of interesting to look at this as a short form work and then to just kind of segue all the way back to the shorts for a minute and think about the evolution of, you know, Robert Zemeckis' relationship to, you know, big surreal cartoony performances and design and shots and whatever, because I think a lot of that evolution is about realizing he needs to balance those things with some restraint. And by restraint, I mean basically creating a real world before he kind of splinters off into his crazy surreal world, spiritual world. Like we in Back to the Future, that the delineation is clear. We have a very grounded, you know, just think about how grounded the first scene in Marty McFly's house is relative, you know, when Biff is chewing out his dad, even though a lot of the performances are big, but how grounded that is relative to like the introduction of Kurt Russell's character in Used Cars or whatever the thing is, where it kind of starts at 11 right away.
Right.
And I think what we're seeing here is the same thing. Now, what's interesting is he doesn't require that transition into a dream world. We could have had a movie where we had a much more grounded version of Professor Beans. You know, he's a grumpy old man who then becomes larger than life once we get into the kind of the dream world, once he comes back from the dead. But instead, what he was able to do in Back to the Future, I think that was wonderful, was he was able to kind of create a grounded world where somehow at the same time these cartoony characters can kind of occupy space, and these big performances can share space with characters who we relate to in a very real way. Now what we see in this one is, of course, a very silly as it is, kind of this relatable dilemma. A kid, he's late to class, he needs to get in, he's looking through the window, his girlfriend's helping him get in, and then he gets caught by the professor. Think about our view of that guy and who he is at that point versus once we've kind of crossed that threshold and we're in the cemetery, and now he's like has some garden shears around a skeleton hand that he's trying to cut off, but he's like shaking so bad like he's Elmer Fudd in a cartoon that he can't, and he trips backwards and the hand goes into a cauldron and fire's bursting out of it and all that other kind of shit. But what's interesting is that this is one of the things that kind of works. So we revisited the shorts. Let me start with that and say we watched them this morning. And to touch on Field of Honor for a second, Field of Honor is a short that kind of blossoms ultimately into an elaborate Chuck Jones war thing about a guy who gets out of it. But like Chuck Jones,
plus Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Chuck Jones plus Doctor Strangelove plus a little bit of a, you know, yeah. Anyway, but if a guy who gets out of an asylum, he goes on a like crazy rampage because he thinks that the kind of war has followed him back to society, and he ends up, you know, shooting a bunch of people with a rifle, but it's all played for kind of big, dark, you know, black comedy. But that probably the part of that short that works the least well out of the whole thing is the opening 2 minutes. And I don't, you know, and to say the whole thing is great, but in the opening 2 minutes, we're trying to get a sense of the reality. It's trying to teach us the cartoony reality, the kind of, again, Bugs Bunny nature of the thing, where a guy's getting out of an asylum, but all of his possessions that are being returned to him.
The broken photo of his family.
The
war book.
A military helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all of that. And because right from minute one, the doctor's acting like a weird cartoon character, the guy's acting like a weird cartoon character, he clearly has such an enthusiasm for being able to be silly on camera that he's asking everyone to be silly all the time.
Right.
And so, versus if the film didn't show its hand right away and we had more of a grounded scene about a guy who's a veteran and he's getting out of an asylum and all of that, and then we allowed some of that and we kind of empathize with him in a human way, and then it blossoms into this cartoony thing later on, the film would feel more dynamic. And I think the point being that is, I think, where we get to by, you know, certainly by Back to the Future, but definitely by this Amazing Stories thing, where, you know, there's an awareness that let's get people on board. You know, let's cast, you know, an actor from a John Hughes movie. Let's get in here and make people care about these kids as real kids, and then we can launch into the fucking stratosphere of it being basically a Three Stooges thing after that.
It's just rope-a-dope, basically, where it's like, okay, we got to get you used to this so we can surprise you here and surprise you here and surprise you here. And I think you're right about that that opening scene of A Field of Honor, because even if you just change that opening scene and have it play a bit straighter, like the second The Great Escape score starts playing, you know what, you kind of get a sense. And then the short Field of Honor does escalate in a way that does do some of the things that you're talking about. It's just that first scene.
And really quick, before we move on to Field of Honor, just to touch on that thing, you know, it's not just an issue of rope-a-dope that is an element to it, you know, to have a more grounded beginning and then have things go crazy. But I think that it reflects a more mature awareness of what the different components in the story actually mean, and like what, in the sense that, you know, that the real world, essentially Back to the Future is also a movie about a dream. We kind of talked about that last time, but in that there's an aesthetic voice, there's an aesthetic space that is deployed when we're in the grounded world, you know, things are darker and moodier, and when he enters his house at the beginning, there's a look to that because that's his real life. And then when he goes, obviously it's much more explicit in Back to the Future, he literally goes to a different world, you know, he goes through the looking glass, Alice tumbles down the hole, goes to a different world, and then there's a different, much more kind of romanticized color palette and visual language that's all happening there. That's, you know, the other side. And that's what's happening here too, where he realizes that, you know, in order for us to, if that's the purpose that the dream world is going to serve, if that's the purpose that the horror is going to serve, then we first have to understand what this is, a dreamlike, you know, exaggeration, metaphor, whatever.
Building contrast. You know. You're talking about building contrast. Yeah.
And we want to realistically, and that's what that first bit does, is it realistically makes us understand, empathize with the idea of, and it's a thing that probably a lot of guys can relate to, that idea of dating a girl who's a little bit pretty. I think it's not guys and girls, but dating someone who maybe is a little out of your league
and
a little abusive as a result of being out of your league, and then that making you feel really small as a result of that. And that's what's wonderful about that scene, as big as Christopher Lloyd is being, that
it's
dynamic
in them.
Yeah, I know, that dynamic, that the idea that she copied his paper and now she just won't fess up to it and is making him take the blame for it is just so kind of dark and grounded and weird that it makes you empathize for him in a very human way, so that when we see all of this other again, when we see the mythology of it later, being literally tempted to perform black rituals, like, and quite literally what they're doing in that sense by, you know, by doing black magic is just wishing bad stuff. You know, what happens if you lose faith and instead of taking responsibility and changing your life, you instead think it's other people's fault, like your teacher, and you decide to, you know, just wish bad things on them, and how that kind of destroys yourself. And as we get into these big symbolic versions of all of that, we first need to remember, you know, back in the real world, what all of this means. And that one little moment grounds everything that happens after that in something that people can genuinely empathize with. It's like, that's why her name is Sin, and she wants him to do witchcraft and all that other kind of stuff, is it's all a big exaggeration of that really grounded human thing. And if you don't have that at the beginning, if you don't have that, then you just have a movie about witchcraft and stuff. Then you just right. have a movie about people doing spells. Then you just purely have melodrama, and it has nothing. It has, there's no, again, it's the furnace that heats the rest of the house. So, anyway, I had to like touch on that one thing. Sure. And that those kind of dynamics that you don't see in A Field of Honor, because he was very, very young, and that you do see later on as he began to figure out when to deploy the craziness and when not to deploy the craziness, I think just reflects a maturity of just understanding, oh, that's what time travel is, that's what magical spells are, you know, we need to connect them back to something that is relatable in a very human way.
Right, and even with Back to the Future, like, the idea was never, it's a time travel movie, it was, the source was, well, what if, would I be friends with my dad, and mm-hmm. what if my mom had the hots for me? And yes. Obviously we talked a bit deeper than that on the last episode, mm-hmm. but like the idea is not time travel in and of itself. It's the relationship pieces.
Word. We were just getting back to a field of Honor, a film. This has the best poster quote, by the way, ever for any movie, because this is a film that, and I believe I'm getting this right from a previous interview we saw around the time of I Want to Hold Your Hand. Mm-hmm. It is a film that John Milius called socially irresponsible. And if John Milius, for those of you who don't know, incredible, influential writer and filmmaker and person who is influential in Hollywood and in culture in a way that I don't think that is way bigger than the amount of people who are familiar with the name John Milius. So he's director of Conan the Barbarian, was instrumental in the founding of, you know, the Ultimate Fighting Championship.
He was?
Weird. Yeah. He was training with the Gracies at the time. It just was a weird... He's influenced everything that's masculine and manly.
And
the Dirty Harry 44 Magnum speech he wrote, all this kind of thing.
Isn't John Goodman and Big Lebowski kind of based on him?
Yes, that is a good thing. Is that John Goodman's character, Walter Solchak, and Big Lebowski is very much him kind of playing up a John Milius archetype, with same with the strap beard and the hair, and the Coen brothers have said they based it on John Milius. So this is a film that, if you can imagine Walter Solchak from Big Lebowski calling a film socially irresponsible, I guess that's the best poster quote you could possibly... My goal now is to retroactively earn that regard. That's a high watermark. Like, what could you do? And it turns out the answer to that question, to make John Milius think that your movie is socially responsible, is to take a which I think he said lovingly, I should say. They were buds and they shot together. Yeah. It wasn't that he was actually reprimanding him, but that it's about a veteran who gets out of a war hospital or whatever. He returns to society. Violence breaks out on the bus on his way, literally on his way home. The violence breaks out, and like right away, from the moment he walks out the door, he's nearly trampled by what?
Protesters.
A series of protesters, yes.
Being it really chased kind of by feels, police. Yeah.
It could be a short made today. But he's trampled by protesters and then by police. And again, this is the same sort of territory that, in a very different way, Paul Schrader would touch on in Taxi Driver, and Martin Scorsese would touch on in Taxi Driver and other things. The idea of the soldier returning home to an America that, of course, is unrecognizable to him because it's now covered with protesters and counterculture and moral decay and all that other stuff, which we would see, again, show up in little bits in Back to the Future and stuff, but I imagine was a very zeitgeisty idea at the time, is that contrast,
totally.
You know, between, yeah, and still is today.
Right. And deciding to, I think not only deciding to do that. Like, looking back on it too, no. Like, he cited Kubrick as a huge source.
The Strange Love things.
It feels exactly Dr. Strange.
It's making some, and the social responsibility thing makes a lot of sense. And as much as we joked about it, in the sense that, not unlike clearly, Dr. Strangelove, you know, was praised and is great for, but this is what would have been in his mind for taking a like deadly serious topic like nuclear annihilation and
turning it thumbing into a cartoon.
Turning it into a cartoon, into a comedy in a very kind, in a very mischievous sort of a way.
Just
and so you
brash.
See, he's going to take something that's very, the idea of soldiers returning home, being damaged, shooting people, butting up against protests. These are all very, very, very potent, scary things, which in retrospect, they seem kind of goofy, but at the same time, in that moment, feel, you know, very, very serious, and basically turn it into a Chuck Jones cartoon.
And it's
where literally
like
go ahead.
You feel bad. I felt bad watching it because where it goes at the end, he's like, he's beating civilians up and it's played for comedy. And then he shoots the woman who throws a plant at him. Which is played for comedy. And it's funny.
Yes, it is.
And he rips the cop light, the siren light, off of a cop car and bashes a cop with it. It's played for comedy, Looney Tunes. And even the Dr. Strangelove thing, like his father's in a wheelchair and he's got a great line. It's time for us to stop being pushed around and it's time for us to stand our ground.
That's worth mentioning. So he finally gets home. He finally makes it home only to find, as a sort of pulling back a little bit more the veil on who this guy is, he has a dad who is a like one-armed, wheelchair-bound, insane military man who is upset that he's not returning home in uniform, and then immediately interprets whatever inarticulate jabbering noises he's making as a direct indication that they are under attack.
Invasion.
Invasion from the enemy. So he bursts outside, insane later on, and starts fights, beats a guy up, lady throws a pot at him, he shoots her, and then eventually, and I think the funniest moment in the movie is that rather than letting the darkness of the content morph the tone of the thing into darkness, like it even has a beat at the end, which is, again, feels, that is maybe the thing that makes it feel the most like a Looney Tunes cartoon. It was when he returns back. Yeah, he returns back to the asylum, and they're like, all right, start at the beginning. And the idea, of course, the implication being that there's that Looney Tunes idea of, oh, it comes back full circle when what was the gangster who would always, with the big guy who would always, you know, there was a gangster who's a tall hat who would fight with Bugs Bunny. I don't remember, but many of the episodes would return with him going back into prison or sneaking back into prison, which, of course, the Coen brothers would do a little bit, would do at the end of Raising Arizona with John Goodman and the other guy. And so what's funny about that is loaded with kind of two levels of interesting meaning, because A, it obviously harkens back to cartoons, getting the guy going back into prison, but start at the beginning, and that circular structure implies that we're going to go right back around and do this again, which in a cartoon or a Looney Tunes type thing is a funny gag on which to end. But for this, it implies that he's probably going to get released, he's probably going to go crazy again, he might murder more people again and then land himself right back there. So it has a really interesting dark, black, comedic, satiric core, sort of a bent to it at the end, which I think if you take that ending off of it, back at the asylum, then the whole film prior to that just sort
falls
of
apart,
loses focus. But once you get to the end, you're like, ah, cool, which is a sign, I think, of a good ending.
Yeah, and I think it also ties to something that you were talking about in the last episode with Back to the Future, in terms of, well, what is the generation after the bomb, and what is their relationship to the world, and because you have the father who's a World War II vet, who's very confident and strong willed, and this isn't going to happen to us, and we're gonna go tackle them, and then you have our hero who is the Vietnam vet, who is kind of a wiener in a war that we didn't win, coming back and has no idea how to, and he's just trying to please his father. He can't. And so there's that element in there as well.
Yep, yep. Yep. And the only really, prior to getting to the dad, then the construction worker on the bus, of course, also represents that same, that same sort of, that same idea where he is a construction worker who immediately sees him with the helmet, thinks he's a compatriot, and starts talking about how yellow and lily livered everyone, and he just looks around at just normal looking, just vaguely counterculturally looking young people, and he grabs one of them and starts punching him, and then that guy reveals himself to be an undercover FBI agent.
That's who my then, favorite part.
Yes, and
that's
then
my favorite
and
part.
Then, yes,
we're and taking when, this bus to Cuba.
Exactly.
Stop, drop the gun. This is the FBI.
Yeah, and in a sense, that beat the when it can't get sillier, a literal Cuban terrorist stands up to hijack the bus and take the bus to Cuba. Of course, there were planes being hijacked and taken to Cuba, whatever. But of course, that is that last threshold that we cross where we know we are now entering a cartoon. You know, because of course you can't drive a bus to Cuba, ladies and gentlemen. And I think that kind of gives the film, it sets the film up, it gives the film a weird permission to go as nuts as it does later with the beating of the guy with the rifle and the shooting of people
shooting
and everything.
The neighbor. Yeah.
All things that make sense in that kind of cartoony logic where a Cuban terrorist could show up on a bus suddenly. So.
And there's and it's talking about Zemeckis as a stunt guy, like his first big, The Lift is a much smaller film, but this you have the stunts are the moving bus, and the bus is going all over the road. There's the car that hits the trash can, but you can see inside the bus people are being thrown around as the bus is moving. And there's that great shot where the bus turns sharply, everybody goes to one side, and then his head, just his eyes with the helmet on, pop up behind the thing, which is. So beautiful. So fun.
Yeah, very, very funny. And we should talk about The Lift also, which I guess was his earlier short film, which much simpler idea. It feels very feels very much like a film school type of a short film about an elevator eating a man. About an evil elevator, and it takes its time telling this little short, and it's a similar idea where it just has a similar structure to in one way to A Field of Honor, in that the ending sort of retroactively defines the entire concept of the movie prior to that. Because it's basically about initially a kind of unfortunate man who nothing's quite working out for him. The elevator's broken. He goes to a humdrum job. Everything looks monotonous. And then we realize that the elevator seems almost sentient and almost seems to be toying with him as he goes to and from work. You know, with sequences of the elevator avoiding him, stopping halfway up, just really causing him to have to run all over creation. And right about the time that silly gag has run its course, it then transitions into kind of, again, pulls back a little bit more of the veil because it finally it pays off with the idea the guy has a heart attack on the stairs, dies, they load him onto a gurney, and then we realize that the people have to load the gurney onto the elevator to send it down, and then the last shot is, of course, the elevator sucking his body in the thing. Just the elevator goes down, and we see his body disappearing, but specifically disappearing where we see it kind of being consumed. We see the lip of the floor and it disappearing behind underneath it, so it feels much more like he's disappearing into a mouth. Anyway, it's sort of it's one of those cool things where your estimation, your esteem for the thing, your enjoyment of the short just continues to grow over the course of the film and grow. So you're enjoying it at the beginning. You're like, okay, I'm on board with this. Oh, now this is more interesting. And then by the time you make it to the end, you're like, I get everything, etc. Another good, fun ending. So.
It reminded me of Chad's shorts. It felt like a very Chad short film to me.
Trying to remember any of our friend Chad's shorts. Which one?
He had one.
A long time ago.
He had one where Ben got stuck in a television. It was like Ben versus a television. It just felt like it just very dry, dark humor. It felt very much like a Chad Leather short.
Yeah.
I haven't seen his stuff in a while either. But it does feel
You know what it felt like to me? What it reminded me of? It reminded me of a short film that we shot on film on Super 8. in film school, which with you and the rat and the piece of cheese, it was uh-huh. exactly, you know, that, and this is the easiest way to sum it up. You know, that vaguely Eraserhead type of short film that seems to have always existed mm-hmm. since the beginning of time. It's one of those. That's what the lift is. It's that vaguely, it's black and white. There's a guy, a lot of sounds, you know,
there's no talking. It's all
one
silent.
Of those. And we made one of those, and a bunch of people. You were wearing a suit in yours, in that as well, because mm-hmm. for some reason we all got to make one. Apparently, so.
Yeah, you made a couple.
I did,
because there was the rat in my ear, and there was the smudge one.
God, I don't even remember
the,
that
the ink blot. But yeah, it's the horror film where fill in the blank is the is the villain was just the. Just feels very, very film school, like a gnome, maybe.
Yes, just like a gnome, yeah. No, but let's get back to Amazing Stories. I enjoy the shorts, but the shorts, and we also should note that apparently with Field of Honor, that's how, as we learned in when we're doing I Want to Hold Your Hand and Use Cars, etc., that's when he met Spielberg, was Spielberg seeing those things. Yep. And you can begin to see, you know, what was potent and exciting about, especially Field of Honor, that would have interested a Spielberg, because so much of seeing that kind of that Looney Tunes Chuck Jones approach being mixed with this kind of like black comedy, the social satire, it immediately kind of expands the palette of what you can do with those types of aesthetics. The kind of in there, and you know. And especially if you compare, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark to Jaws or something like that, where Jaws, you see maybe some more Hitchcock and some more suspense cinematography and all of that. But by the time you make it to Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, if you want an elaboration on this idea, listen to the previous episodes of this podcast where we talked about it a bunch. But you see that fully matured, cartoony Chuck Jones influence fully folded in and integrated in a mature way into Spielberg's filmography.
Right.
And so you can see, looking back at a film like Field of Honor, he probably saw the potency of, like, holy shit, like, you can do Chuck Jones, but if you radically change...
This kid is doing it.
Yeah. But if you radically change the content, then you can repurpose these tools for different things. And we see that in its biggest, silliest expression, a film that feels very much like Field of Honor in a lot of ways, 1941. Mm-hmm. You know, when, like, we have to defend the house and they're putting on helmets and they're going to defend their house from an invasion. It feels like, you know, and originally 1941 started, I guess, as a script for John Milius, and then ultimately Spielberg directed it.
I think it was a Milius idea.
Yeah.
And so... just Field of Honor won Zemeckis a Student Academy Award. Like, he got a special mm-hmm. jury prize. So it had some clout behind it, obviously.
That is very interesting to think back on, because I was not something I was aware of, but now I hear Student Academy Award, I'm like, wow, that was a different time.
Yeah, it's really strange. Sorry, just one second. Alexa, off. But yes.
It's good to see you guys are working it out.
Yeah. won a special jury prize, Student Academy Award, which then he barges past Spielberg's secretary to show him, having cornered him at a screening of Sugarland Express at USC. Which then, of course, led to them. Spielberg, of course, loved the thing.
You can see a direct line so much between this and 1941.
Right.
So and much of the same energy. Yeah.
That was their first gig, actually, was writing 1941 mm-hmm. for Spielberg, because Spielberg saw this and wanted to play in that zone. So, and these mm-hmm. two guys, they could write something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is interesting looking back at 1941 too, because with Field of Honor, you have this. It feels like it's very much inspired by Kubrick in a lot of ways. I think that mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense. And we talked about when we had Cliff on for 1941, like, was Spielberg trying not to go at that direction? It feels like he's explicitly walking away from some of the Kubricky stuff.
Well, no, but that's the thing. But Spielberg was a radically different filmmaker.
Totally.
I mean, he had a very different point of view, and clearly even he didn't make a film that was as dark or as he did not make a film that was as, you know, as black and satirical as what's it called, A Field of Honor. But, you know, he never really would for the rest of his career. Totally. This is not his sensibility. And so it's very interesting to see how, and I think that this is, I mean, this is most people, most great filmmakers, you know, are not most people, because he's a really fucking good filmmaker. You can see that he could potentially anticipate how he could repurpose. And you can see the evolution of that repurposing of that Chuck Jones type of shit over and over and over again. And 1941 being kind of the expensive train set on which he kind of experimented. He learned how to use these things. He's literally doing with the coat hanger thing versions of gags that would show up later in Raiders, and not unlike the relationship between A Field of Honor and these Amazing Stories episode. God, I'm good. I can just tie it all together. But not unlike that, how we were talking about how it's good that Zemeckis learned that you needed to kind of get in on a grounded level before you, and to empathize with the characters so that you know what all the crazy shit is supposed to be, and so that you relate to the characters and their POV going through all of that. All that shit in the woo. Oh, sorry, I just got a text message. I'll turn that off. There we go. But in that same way, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark has that kind of relationship to 1941. I'm sorry, I'm going way out on a limb on this,
but
I think you understand, in the sense that what does Raiders of the Lost Ark has, like, when Marion is facing off with, mm-hmm. is running Malek. Through the sequence with the baskets, it has lots, is every bit as Chuck Jonesy as aspects of 1941. But because those have had, just like we were talking about with Amazing Stories, grounded moments prior to that, moments that exist in the real world where we can empathize with the characters a little bit more, even as heightened as all of that shit ultimately gets in Indiana Jones, you can see how the two things are balanced out. And you can see, and that makes those Chuck Jones moments really sing, because it's not the whole of the film. It's sort of this escalation of energy and heightening of what's going on relative to how we've seen the characters before. It doesn't fucking matter. But you can see where that fascination comes from. You feel like you can almost see now the complete arc of them meeting and collaborating after this Field of Honor movie, and then all of the divergent paths that would have taken them on through 1941 all the way to Back to the Future. Yes, all the way through Back to the Future, and then finally circling all the way back around with this Amazing Stories episode, which really doesn't fit into this whole story we were telling up to this point, except the fact that we watched it this week. And so we're going to talk about that some more.
Well, there's one more thing. I mean, about the shorts that I want to say is they are totally worth watching, because having been through film school, I feel they feel like they're makeable. And there's this, and the attitude behind them is something that I certainly recognize, and I think you'll appreciate this. There's one quote I could find for this episode was when Zemeckis met Bob Gale at USC. He says the graduate students at USC had this veneer of intellectualism, so Bob and I gravitated toward one another because we wanted to make Hollywood movies. We weren't interested in French New Wave. We were interested in Clint Eastwood and James Bond and Walt Disney, because that's how we grew up, which is something that you and I certainly shared while we were in school too.
No, for sure.
Let's make the silly horror things that we want to make instead of something inspired by the French New Wave. And then you look at something like Amazing Stories, which is definitely a callback to the old horror films, even starting with one of them.
Which puts Bob Zemeckis in an interesting position, and I think that it's something that we, you know, and let's really make it about us, I struggled with in the past when searching for kind of identity as filmmakers, and what which is how do you make films with depth if you want to work in a mode where at least the tastemakers of the time do not acknowledge depth can exist within that type of genre or that type of filmmaking. We don't it's different, a little bit different now. I only have a vague recollection of it from kind of pre-internet film criticism, like when you would read, the review in the morning paper. Like I would read the review in the Dallas Morning News of movies.
Same.
Where it was assumed that, you know, popular entertainments or especially things that had a horror aspect were just DOA in terms of good reviews. Those were not part of the conversation. And it was quite revolutionary post-internet. It eventually turned into something kind of ugly. But it was a kind of revolutionary, you know, when a lot of the early kind of movie review websites and the geek websites started popping up. That idea that, you know, that genre movies or popular entertainments could be or were
could be art.
Were great, yeah. Were art and were a con. Yes, and I'm not saying that was where that conversation originated, but at the same time, we're in an interesting place because you see, it puts Bob Zemeckis in an interesting place, which is he clearly has a commitment to a high level, not just a high level of craft, which is what he gets credit for. It's sort of the only thing that people give him credit for, a high level of craft. But he also seriously has a commitment. He and Bob Gale have a commitment to this kind of really deep and kind of thematically layered and symbolic
dense.
And nuanced storytelling.
Very
but
dense.
With and you have to assume that he, you know, it's interesting because I think it recognizes on a certain level that these things are not part of the movie. I don't know. This is my take on it. I don't think that it's a maturity to recognize that these things are not part of the movie because he wants people to see them or notice them. They're not part of the movie. Like, why integrate all of this Shakespeare business and everything in all of these archetypes into this episode of Amazing Stories? It's not there to be pointed at. Though you can kind of see with the Shakespeare stuff at the beginning, he's trying to call attention to it. He's like, Hey, someone notice, please. You know, that he's doing it because he knows it will make the things he is doing more potent. And in that sense, Robert Zemeckis is not unlike the girl in this episode, in that he knows that he has to conjure some powerful magic, you know, for this thing. He's trying to conjure powerful magic, and he knows that, and we definitely see this in Back to the Future, that supernatural aspect, that spiritual aspect, and taking that seriously, and not just taking it seriously in terms of getting the iconography in there, the bolt of lightning coming down and hitting the clock tower,
the fire,
the magical ritual. The magical ritual where they're literally using like rose water and stuff, which is stuff that's in a lot of witchcraft rituals, but taking the emotional logic of it seriously. Like, mm-hmm. Why, you know, it is difficult for, it's like, and we're not going to get to, you know, we'll get to Contact when we get to Contact later on.
Right.
But, you know, that many of his films have a kind of spiritual logic to them that makes it's a little bit baffling to people who have a highly kind of materialistic and atheistic worldview.
Well, you've been calling it the moral universe, the moral universe of Robert Zemeckis.
Oh yes, of Robert Zemeckis, exactly. But it's one that where if you imagine that he takes seriously the spiritual logic of these things, which you can say is just either inherited story business from Joseph Campbell or whatever. But I think genuinely it's because, and I think the whole breadth of his filmography reveals this, that he really does believe in these things, you know, that he really does believe that, think of his version of a kind of corrupt and abusive relationship, which in this thing, which has direct supernatural consequences on corrupting the soul and leading to the direct annihilation of our protagonist. That's one way of doing it versus, you know, a John Hughes movie, which is kind of the energy on which this would start, where the kids would talk circles about things that were far more bound to the real world, would talk about detention and dating
right.
and a bunch of other shit. It is that you can view this as like an entertainment full of great craft and lots of other things, but you can also view these things not just as mythological archetypes that he's evoking. You can, I think that he takes these ideas seriously. Like, he really does believe that something potentially, we threw some baby out with the bathwater. There was some original sin, like the atomic bomb, that we're trying to work out in the 80s. He really does take this idea seriously that if someone, if you allow yourself to be kind of overtaken by someone else, if you give up your sense of self to someone else, it will lead to your annihilation. It will lead to the loss of yourself. I think he he takes these ideas seriously, and that is, and as a result, that's where the power comes from. That's where the power of these moments comes from. Anyway.
No, I
you dig it.
Yeah, I dig it. I can totally
you dig it,
that.
Richard.
Yeah, of course I do.
You
I
dig
think
it.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
It does. It makes a lot of sense, Richard. It's funny. We might be getting off topic. I kind of made a mistake this morning. It was a total coincidence. I turned on my Apple TV and I pulled up the YouTube and had popped up some, you know, you watched movie things. Watch this, and it was a video essay of a guy going through the filmography of Bob Zemeckis.
Yeah, Patrick, and just did sort you of see Patrick Williams.
Yes, Patrick Williams. Yeah, I had a tough time getting through it, but I did watch.
I watched it too.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But I thought it was funny because we, on the Back to the Future episode, were discussing a kind of concept that I was kind of half remembering from, like, when I used to get into conversations about Back to the Future in film school 10 years ago, but I was beginning to lose faith and maybe it was still part of the potent conversation, but we were talking about it, and I was like, yeah, I just feel like people only, when they think of Back to the Future, they think about, like, yes, it is a meticulously structured movie. Yes, it is full of setups and payoffs. Yes, they wrote it on note cards. But that really is, like,
yes, Eric Stoltz
scratching.
Was fired.
Yes, Eric Stoltz was fired, exactly. And so what was funny to me was saying all that stuff in the podcast and then later on being like, I don't know, maybe I was being too harsh on people in general. Maybe people do have a greater respect for the thing than I was giving it credit for. And then I ended up watching that video essay and I realized, oh man, I was so fucking right. Like, just watching how, I don't know, I don't want to run anyone down, but just basically watching how thin and well, let me put it this way.
Well, I think that when I watched it, sorry to cut you off, but when I watched it, I was pretty shocked at how it's kind of, I want to hold your hand and use cars
yes.
kind of get written off.
Let me concretize the whole point making with that we've talked a couple of times about the idea about that on multiple episodes about the Nancy Allen moment at the end of the thing. And this was the thing where when I said it was hard for me to watch the rest of it was right off the bat. He goes, we're going to go the whole filmography. And he says, we're going to start with, I want to hold your hand. And he actually mentions the Nancy Allen moment. Why? Because it's clearly a potent moment. You have to mention it, but the interpretation of it is so bizarre. He, in that it starts with, what does he say? I believe he says, and at the end, when she finally gets to see the Beatles, you know, and all of the kind of freedom and youth that the freedom of youth they represent, she breaks down and starts crying. And it's a really beautiful moment. And I'm like, were you checking your Twitter at mentions while the movie was happening? And I was just, it's the kind of thing where if you enter into Bob Zemeckis on the level of the popular discourse, which is his films are absent any depth. And they're merely are kind
special
of these
effects. Vehicles for special effects.
Yes, they are entertainments that don't have any that don't have anything else that they are have exquisite craft and screenplay structure. Basically, all the things that I mean to be fair, all the things that in general film critics and film bloggers sort of are capable of noticing about films in terms of they are the readily identifiable aspects. They are the surface of the thing. Yes, there are setups, there are payoffs. Yes, there is structure to it. Yes, it is incredibly well crafted. But what I found was interesting was you then saw that kind of misinterpret. The point being that moment with Nancy Allen that we've talked about multiple times is so about, has a wildly different and far more, what is the word I'm looking for? Just far more naughty energy to it. Like the entire film is about female sexuality boiling over. And there's so many metaphors for sex and how do they feel about sex. And the Beatles, seeing the Beatles represent getting laid. And when Nancy Allen cries at the end of I Want to Hold Your Hand, well, let's just say it's supposed to evoke a different energy other than the most notably in the shot where, as we've talked about many times, it moves from her head to her crotch. It's supposed to represent slightly, and I think for most people it does, but the point being it made me realize it is a good thing that we are doing this podcast,
because
it occurs to me that so many of these things, if you're just merely willing to look for them, are there. But I think it's so not a part of the conversation about him, you know, it's all about craft, that honestly no one's looking for it, you know, and so they assume it doesn't exist.
That was my frustration with that video too. And I like Patrick Williams quite a bit, but like I said, Used Cars and I Want to Hold Your Hand, both kind of written off as just kind of fun jaunts when having watched them and talked about them with you and shared them with our friend group, who's all like, Used Cars, oh my God, I Want to Hold Your Hand, my God. Like, they're kind of revelations to
me. Well, and again, the thing is, I think we're in a bit of a distortion field ourselves, and most of our friends are filmmakers who have worked in media and that sort of thing, and kind of could see where the craft elements become a little bit more transparent, which sort of happens.
Right.
But yeah, it's the kind of thing where I ended up watching through the whole video and we'll get to this eventually, but it'll be because I haven't revisited Beowulf in forever.
I'm
so I'll be very
to
curious
to
very curious to revisit Beowulf. But what was funny was and you knew at that point, and I knew that this would be the case by that point, but there was a moment where he says Beowulf, this mythological story or whatever, which there's no reference point for in the whole history of his filmography up to this point for having done a movie like this. And I'm like, there's not? Really?
There's
quite a bit. I know. And just the same that he seems to be a filmmaker preoccupied with ancient stories. He seems to be a filmmaker preoccupied with archetypes. He seems to be a filmmaker, in the case of this Amazing Stories episode, preoccupied with the stories that underlie Shakespeare's work rather than necessarily replicating. And someone's going to say that he's directly replicating a Shakespeare. But I mean, it's obviously Lady Macbeth, but it's not Macbeth.
Right.
But he's telling the story that's under the story for Shakespeare. He's clearly obsessed with these old mythological stories being reframed in a modern context or recontextualized through modern iconography and stuff. And so it's just that it was a heartening, so to end this on kind of a positive note, let this podcast be one of the first things that gets out there and lets people know, hey, it's okay to look below the surface of Robert Zemeckis. It's really there, I promise.
So, yeah, and I totally, totally, totally agree. And I think it's on the first sentence of his Wikipedia page. It's a director that's all about special effects, and that feels so false to me. certainly, that is a theme that pervades, and he is has pushed things continually. But it's always been done with an eye to how does this better tell the story. Obviously Marwin we'll get to, which neither of us have seen, but in terms of Roger Rabbit and the synchro scan on I Want to Hold Your Hand and some of the motion control stuff in Back to the Future 2, which we'll get to soon enough. Excuse me. Just saying he's a special effects director just entirely removes the understanding of how he understands story and how he positions story, and also misses that he's a very tonally broad. He takes huge swings tonally,
and even more so than the surface of things. Also, there's just that idea that if you walk away from I Want to Hold Your Hand and you think that the integrating and guiding ideas behind that film aren't all about sexuality.
Right.
And what sex meant in that period and how the Beatles, how they related directly to sex, you know, then you realize that there's an orientation. And I think it is just a more kind of literally bound or materialist orientation towards looking at his films that is only about the surface of things. And I think that's the truth. That's not just Robert Zemeckis. I think that's sort of the idea of, you know, has been the idea of that the intelligentsia has sort of held about many popular entertainers or many popular filmmakers.
James Cameron.
And I think. Yes, and I think that part of the reason for that, is just that idea that if something is extremely popular, then the what it is doing right. If Robert Zemeckis is making hit after hit, and they're very weird kind of films, or James Cameron's doing the same thing, and that film doesn't abide by whatever, you know, the aesthetic texture of the moment is that people kind of associate with quote unquote good films.
If it doesn't touch Bordwell's blog.
Exactly. The texture of profundity of that moment, then there is an assumption that, well, that it can't, it's not participating in any conversation other than that which is literally bound. That is to say,
right.
camera movement, structure, craft. And that is especially the case with filmmakers like Bob Zemeckis or James Cameron, who where those craft elements are on, especially with Bob Zemeckis, who really puts him on Front Street with his long takes and cool shots and everything and big cartoony angles. The craft is so exquisite that it is very easy for one to make a one-to-one relation between, well, that his things are wildly commercially successful purely because the craft is exquisite. Because that drawing that line, that very, very straight line between the film's craft and its commercial success is a way to sort of account for him as a filmmaker without right. giving him the credit for actually having had a voice. But, and I get it, because to understand Robert Zemeckis in that way would require sort of interpreting his films according to a different set of aesthetic guidelines than were pervasive at the time. I get it. Like, I get why that conversation started. I understand. It's a revolutionary act that we're committing now, Richard, to go back and reappraise all of his films. But in that way, I just, I don't know. It was I'm glad I watched that thing this morning because it made me suddenly full of purpose as I took to the podcast this morning, that I was like, oh, this conversation is actually potentially going to be informative and necessary for only, if only for one person, Richard.
Yeah. Me.
Whoever our one listener is. Yes, exactly.
No, I felt the exact same way watching it and, just in, yeah. And it gets back in terms of what I wanted to get out of this, which is just understanding a bit more, because he is so weird, just learning. I wanted to kind of glean as much as I could in terms about like what makes his things work. Like, how does it work? Mm-hmm. How can he have all these hits and swing so big tonally? Because like it's just in another level. I love it. It's the kind of things that I want to be doing.
Well, the rebuke to the argument that that Robert Zemeckis is all craft and that accounts for things is how many other failed filmmakers have we seen attempting to make versions of Back to the Future or versions of Raiders of the Lost Ark or versions of their knockoff of a James Cameron movie or whatever the thing is. People who we know people who have spent their lives trying to become students of all of the craft elements, all of the kind of literally bound elements of those filmmakers
Spielberg,
from
yeah.
that era.
Yeah.
yeah. And, you can replicate all of those. The point being, there's a ton of fucking films, especially once you started to get into the 90s and that really robust cinema that everyone from Ridley Scott to Robert Zemeckis to Steven Spielberg was, you know, that really robust visual cinema that was beginning to kind of be perfected as it came out of both the commercial world and the film brats and everything in the 80s, mm-hmm. and had just sort of become the standard by the 90s, where if you look at fucking Mrs. Doubtfire. You ever seen that movie recently? It looks gorgeous. Holy shit. It's in San Francisco. It's shot on 35. Everything looks amazing. Like, that was becoming and beginning to saturate. So, the point being, all they were so influential. There's a lot of people trying to rip them off or do those things, and they don't all end up as iconic, and they don't all end up as part of the cultural conversation as something like Back to the Future ultimately became. So there has to be something else, you know. And we've known there's been people for 20 years who have tried to replicate the structural aspects of Back to the Future and create up a bunch. It's not the setups and payoffs. It's not the shots. There has to be another thing. It's like dark matter. There is another thing. We know it's there, and so we have to start looking for it. And then we found it. And that's a great segue into Contact. I wish we were watching that next week, but we're not.
No, that's like a month and a half or 2 months from now. we'll get to that.
We'll get to that eventually.
Yeah, I was thinking last night, I think there's just, I was trying to find a parallel between Zemeckis and somebody else and trying to figure out who that was. And the closest I could get, I don't know if this is correct or not, but Bong Joon-ho came to mind last night.
Wow, that is an interesting one, just, yeah.
But think about how he approaches. I mean, especially Memories of Murder.
But I love it, Richard. I absolutely love it.
Okja is more Zemeckis than it's Spielberg.
Yep.
Just and his kind of bigger swings satirically, mm-hmm. I think there's something more to that. I know that's kind of big and crazy and a silly thing.
No, I'm with you because here's the thing. I think I don't, as much as I don't know if I see the direct line between them. Here's the thing: is I think that one can deploy the same set of criterion when assessing a film like Parasite and assessing a film like Back to the Future. They are much more in the same universe than many other films that came out and were highly critically regarded in the year that Parasite came out, in the sense that both Parasite and Back to the Future are clearly having a conversation on the literal level, as well as a very well thought out symbolic and spiritual conversation at the same time. And they're both really, really well integrated films in that regard. And so what I like about the thing that you said is, I think to most people, that would just sound like nonsense, what you said. It would sound anathema. It would sound like, right. It was like, well, I think Back to the Future or Robert Zemeckis is, but I honestly think that the way in which, and if anything, we have over talked about, you know, the films that get, you know, I mean, Parasite has been discussed. It's a great, great fucking movie, but has been over discussed this year.
So go back though to Memories of Murder, go back to Okja, even Mother. Mother, I think has a lot of just thinking about the themes of what Mother is. It's this weird mother-son relationship.
Well, that's, very, by the way, no, and I'm 100% with you. I don't know if I would attribute it as directly to Zemeckis as it is just to Zemeckis.
I'm not trying to say there's a direct line. Just saying, there's enough. Like,
I know, I'm aware. But the thing is, what I would say is this. What I do agree with you is that a lot of all of that kind of golden age South Korean cinema that emerged and kind of around, you know, the early 2000s, when that's when Bong Joon-ho and Chan-wook Park and Kim Ki-duk and all these guys started popping up. One of the things that these films did that made them so inspiring to us, because that was, they were just, you know, it was a big part of our film school experience, was
not mine,
the
yours,
fact that
not mine. I'm discovering them now.
That's right. But was the fact that they were very playful. They were very goofy. They played with tone, like in the way that many of our favorite American filmmakers, be it Quentin Tarantino or the Coen brothers, did, and that they were alternately very silly and funny and graphic, and then they would just become incredibly dark and symbolic. And obviously with the case especially of a film like Old Boy, almost, which almost is more Zemeckisian in a certain respect than anything that Bong Joon-ho did, in the sense that he's basically directly evoking a bunch of Oedipal stuff, a bunch of there's some explicit myths that are referenced, Count of Monte Cristo, and a bunch of other textual references, which again are then not, you know, just talked about in an arty-farty way, but then repurposed to give substance and meaning and drama to a visceral genre story in the case of Old Boy. So the point being that, like, I think that there is more, I agree with you, there's more of a, in terms of their DNA, a kinship between, you know, the movies of the film brats, you know, whether it's Spielberg, Zemeckis, whomever, and the films of, and let's talk specifically about Zemeckis here, though. There's more of a shared DNA between Zemeckis and, like, a Bong Joon-ho or a Chan-wook Park than there is Zemeckis and all of the other journeyman filmmakers he is often sort of lumped in with, who replicated elements of Spielberg or Zemeckis's craft while making films that we all forgot about, you know? And it's like, it kind of has to be true in the sense, and what I mean by that is, where is the difference? When I'm talking about what is the difference between him and the journeyman filmmakers that were his peers that made films that we have forgotten about, it's merely the fact that, you know, these things, Back to the Future, Roger Rabbit, these things have lived on and have continued to be part of a cultural conversation and continue to be archetypes and characters and symbols that we reach for to communicate things. So the question is not, did he leave some impact beyond the commercial success of the films, but merely how it happened, what accounts for it, and where it's what we're trying to talk about here. So
right. Totally. Anyway, just thought I'd share that.
Just like Bong Joon-ho.
I haven't done too much thought on it, but it came to mind last night, which I think is, yeah, it's worth noting.
Word.
Well, do you want to, did we finish Amazing Stories? Do you want to keep going?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, well, I really, we kind of touched on the episode a little bit. I feel like we talked a lot. We've kind of used it as a portal to talk about like a bunch of different stuff with regard to Robert Zemeckis and almost kind of do a state of the union on the podcast up to this point, which is rad. But yeah, I would say that with the Amazing Stories thing, definitely check it out. I watched it twice, which I rarely ever have done.
I also watched it twice.
Yeah, it's super entertaining. It feels like a undiscovered country in terms of there's this whole huge Christopher Lloyd performance that feels very much a piece with what he did in Roger Rabbit and Back to the Future that I just was not aware of. I mean, he was in a lot of fucking movies, but it's really fucking good. He plays like Professor Beans or Mr. Beans or whatever it is.
I love that. I love his name is Beans, and on the big sarcophagus, it just says Ebenezer Beans, which is it's just funny to me.
Yes, the fact that his name is Ebenezer Beans is good. And I don't know. It is a rad film where you can begin. It's cool to have talked about a certain type of storytelling in theory that was at work with Robert Zemeckis, that idea of it existing in the real world, passing through that conduit into this whole spiritual thing, how those things relate to each other, and then just uncovering another piece, uncovering another thing from that period, and just seeing that, oh, yeah, this is clearly the path that he was on. This is the problem he was trying to solve. And why is that interesting? On another level, given the nature of this podcast, is now seeing how clearly you can see the conversation he wants to have. You can see the ideas he wants to explore, the disparate aesthetic influences he's trying to integrate, and the purposes he's deploying those for. Given all of that, I'm very curious to revisit Your Death Becomes Hers, and then even into Beowulf and Polar Express and all of that other things. Again, yeah. Films about which the entire conversation is the special effects. Like, right. Films about which the entire conversation is Tom Hanks's face. And how it might have looked creepy how it did look creepy in Polar Express. So I'm kind of curious now to revisit and like, well, the film probably also had a story, so I'm going to look at that. And the point being, I'm just very curious to re-examine some of these films now, and I feel have a much more clear sense of what it was Robert Zemeckis was seeking with his movies.
Right. And so what I think the one I'm most looking forward to is Death Becomes Her, I think, especially on the heels of this The Amazing Stories episode and my own proclivities of loving the Evil Dead 2s and the Frighteners and the horror comedies. So that's the one I'm most looking forward to. What about you?
Oh, man. I am excited to get your take on Death Becomes Her. That was a favorite when we were growing up just because it was like vaguely horror-y. So we would watch it whenever it was on TV. And I am really excited to return to Flight later on, which is a film I really loved when it came out. And, though I feel like most people, talk about as if it's something that it's assumed that it didn't work or it was a failed experiment. And I haven't seen it in a lot of years, but I am very, very excited to return to that one. And I'm honestly now more than ever really excited to return to all of the CGI movies, all of the mocap movies, and stuff, because I have a feeling that there's just, again, it's a concretization of everything we've talked about at this point. I don't even remember at this point anything about them or conversations about them that aren't about mocap or aren't about the uncanny valley. It's like it's the Eric Stoltz. Right. It's the postcards of those movies. It's like, what's the point of talking about it? Everyone's talked about it. Let's talk about different aspects of it.
I think we saw Beowulf together. I loved Beowulf when I saw it. I love Raven
You are
Stone.
Just a huge Raven Stone fan. To this day, we still go from Sexy Beast all the time. Yeah. Bacon burning. It's a little bit of a, it's just one of those audio hooks that we were constantly dropping into our conversations.
And one of the it was one of the things I loved about Beowulf is there's that whole myth of the whole myth and the storytelling, the myth of storytelling and telling your own story aspect of the thing where he's telling his own story and he's talking about how good of a hero he is and he's defeating the sea monsters. And at the end of that sequence, he screams his own name. Beowulf screams Beowulf. And that always stuck with me as like, this is, It's something. Yeah. It's definitely something. Yep. And there's a whole lot of his dick being obscured, which...
Well, that's the other thing. It's just, on the same level that, you know, I think that, you know, whether it is your video bloggers, your Patrick H. Willems, or your film critics, or whatever it is, it's hard for them to find meaning in things, and that, for to a large extent, like, themes are regarded, and this is just a thing, the themes are regarded as, like, what the characters are talking about. You know, that's based, right. And as much as I think a lot of film critics would say, that's not how I view it, I think that, to a large extent, that in that it is very textually bound, it is very literally bound to what the film is about. In this, and they assume that if you get one step off that reservation, you're just in cloud cuckoo land, and you're in the ether, and that there's no more logic, or there's no more there's nothing left to interpret. And so there's just the point being that it will be interesting to revisit those films, because I just, because now more than ever, I'm appreciating the fact that 100%, like, when people say that Robert Zemeckis' films, they have trouble finding the meaning, which was something that was in that video essay, trouble finding the meaning, you get the sense that it's from that perspective, which I really don't think emerged until it started to emerge more in the 80s and 90s, and and then into the 2000s, and certainly in this film blogger era that we're in now, of people thinking that, you know, well, what films are about are the things that the characters said and talked about, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, that part was in Vietnam, therefore it's about Vietnam. I'm like, I think I've only recently began to get perspective on how pervasive that view is, that sort of what is it, CinemaSins view of films, right. Those videos where people count the candlesticks that have moved in the background of shots because they think that sort of the surface of things is everything. But the point being that I'm very curious to engage with those films on a slightly, on a just a different level, because they're not unlike the radio signals in Contact. They were things that Robert Zemeckis sent out into the ether, and now finally they may have be landing on a different alien world. And that's this podcast, Richard. That's what we're doing right now.
I agree. he's maybe one of the most misunderstood filmmakers of our time, Kyle.
That's right. And I would say it is a misunderstanding of omission. It is a misunderstanding of, you know, he told things within, he's starting to tell things within a thing that we're basically, no one was looking for it. And so now we're looking for it, Richard. We're getting there.
I'm also really excited to watch The Walk with you. Like, The Walk is part of what spawned this whole idea. Yes. Is that movie is wackadoo in the best way.
Yep.
So excited to get to that one.
Round.
And I love that we're looking forward to the later ones. That makes me so happy. It just it proves the case of what we're doing, I think, in a big way.
That's right. Well, it proves that I don't know if it proves anything about Robert Zemeckis, but it proves that this podcast was a worthy endeavor. And
it was right for us.
Yes. Yeah. It was right for us to do this, and that there might be no value for anyone besides the two of us to finally understand with nuance the intentions of Robert, as best we can, the intentions behind Polar Express or Beowulf. Right. But at the same time, I think that could be extremely useful for us in what we're doing. I just think that that's something I'm just very curious about at this point. But I think at the same time, I just think that it's the kind of thing where certainly, and if it does exist, I haven't heard of it, there just seems to be a dominant a prism through which everyone must view all Zemeckis films. And it is our goal to shatter that prism, Richard, so that people can look at them with new eyes.
That's totally correct. And I'm certainly looking through with new eyes. I know you are too. And there's one kind of, since we are doing the State of the Union, you said something, I forget what episode it was on, but you made reference to Zemeckis as the king of, like, dad jokes. Like, and we love it in the way that our dads love it. It's like, that was a pretty good movie. I liked it. And that came to mind while I was watching Amazing Stories, if only because of the number of like clever puns and lines talking about his head and foreshadowing the fact that he's going to end up with, like, oh, you want to mess with his head. And there's like two or three others. I don't remember them, but it struck me as very dad joke and in a way that is exactly growing out of that approach that you were talking about, is us just kind of being having the dad humor and it being dad humor kind of stuff. I started to see that and feel that in a big way on this. If that
makes sense. No, for sure. I don't know, and that's I think that part of why we talked about this whole thing feeling like it has kind of a dad joke energy to it, both us doing the podcast and Robert Zemeckis' films, and where is that association? And I think maybe we got into it a little bit more on the Romancing the Stone. I don't remember, maybe. But it's worth revisiting, which is just that idea that part of the attraction to this is, why is it that this thing is, we think, is so good and so beloved and so successful, if we look at something like Back to the Future, and yet is not kind of given any credit for being cool or being hip or being smart. And that constellation of feeling tones, I feel like, is the dad joke feeling tone, which is, we all like, for some reason, telling dumb puns to each other or pointing out things that are just silly. We like that dad joke energy, but we are aware that rather than it raising our status to do it, it somehow diminishes our status. Yes. We seem less cool. We seem less hip as a result of everything. And that is the Robert Zemeckis conundrum. And so this whole podcast is about trying to kind of invert that pole if we can, and or be destroyed by it. But we're going to dig in as hard as we can.
Yeah.
We're going to dig in as hard as we can to Robert Zemeckis and say, hey, wait a minute, what if there is a poetry to the dad joke? And that is what we're trying to figure out here, Richard.
I love
it. Is there a poetry to the dad joke?
I love it. Well, Kyle, how do people follow you?
They could follow me on at Mr. Kyle Bogert, though I have been far, far less active in these troubled times on the social media. But please follow me on at Mr. Kyle Bogert on Instagram.
And I and the show are at Bob Zemeckis, spelled in the way that you would expect. I have that Instagram account. It's mine, ours. We own it, buttheads.
At Bob Zemeckis. Bob Zemeckis.
And so next episode, Roger Rabbit, and I believe we're going to have our good friend Brian Satterwhite, composer, who composed the intro and outro music for us. Still waiting.
I haven't even heard yet, because
you heard the Forrest Gumpy part. He's working on the Back to the Future part. We should have that today or tomorrow.
Nice. Of course, by this point, by episode 5, hopefully the audience will be quite familiar with it.
Yes.
We're still producing these.
So we asked Brian if there was an episode he would want to come on to talk about what Alan Silvestri is doing with Robert Zemeckis, and he mentioned Roger Rabbit as being one that he really wanted to come on and talk about.
Awesome.
So we're going to try to get Brian on and start talking a little bit more about musical approach, because Brian is stoked.
Because the one thing we definitely have given not enough talking to, not enough credit to up to this point, is we've given kind of short shrift to Alan Silvestri, because my God, there's a lot going on there to talk about. So I'm really happy that Brian's coming on.
Yeah, and especially for Roger Rabbit, just because hearing Brian talk about it, he's doing the film noir thing and the cartoon thing at an extremely high level, back and forth,
I'm sure Brian would like us to talk this up. And for those who aren't familiar with Brian, if you ever saw the final episode of the video essay series Every Frame a Painting, they do a one on Marvel film scores and the current state of film scores, and that video essay was co-written by Brian Satterwhite and the Every Frame a Painting guy. So if you want to know who our guest is, go look at whatever that Marvel Every Frame a Painting is. And if you know Brian and you've talked to Brian for years, we've known Brian for over a decade at this point, if you talk to Brian about film music, the content in that and the nuance and the level of content in that episode of Every Frame a Painting is pure Brian. So we'll go watch that, and you will get super stoked on and having him here. And he's an awesome guy, and he has his own radio show here in Austin called, or at least he still hosts that radio called Film Score Focus. He's hosted for years.
Yeah.
It's on the classical station here in Austin, all about film scores. And we've been on his radio show before and everything. So so he's definitely going to be a rad. I'm super stoked to have him on for Roger Rabbit.
Same. And we can use it as a musical State of the Union, so to speak, and have him speak about Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future, I'm sure. But we'll focus as much as we can on Roger Rabbit. But anything else you want to say, Kyle?
No, man. Other than I'm just this definitely, this episode made me even more excited that we're doing this podcast, because I'm so glad we saw Amazing Stories. The Satanic Panic heavy metal aspects of it made it particularly potent and interesting for me, and mm-hmm. so it's inspired a lot of conversations here between me and my brother, because we've been writing a lot of stuff about that particular era and researching Paradise Lost and doing like a bunch of other shit. And so like the moment we saw that, we immediately lit up. So this was really exciting, and I never would have watched it, I don't think, certainly not now, if it weren't for this. And it just made me more excited about seeing the rest of the stuff. So
a lot of power in it.
So a lot of magic in it.
A lot of magic. Oh, that's a dad joke.
A lot of magic.
All right. So, buttheads, we'll catch you later. See you for Roger Rabbit.
Later.